Well, I think the last time we chatted, we've chatted on a number of occasions.
Yes.
We did the language of clothes.
Mm-hmm.
We did foreign affairs. We did the truth about Lauren Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're very interesting, and it's always good to have you back.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been very kind to ask me so often.
Well, you're a good interview, and you make sense. I was really fascinated by this book because I have some interest in children's literature, although I'm not that well read in it. Did you read Jonathan Cott's book, Pipers at the Gates of Dawn?
Oh, yes, I did. It's a good book.
Yeah, his premise was that there is a great deal of wisdom in children's literature. Do you subscribe to that?
Oh, I think so, certainly. Not all children's literature. In some, there's a great deal of silliness. But the best children's literature, certainly, I believe that.
You describe children as a partly savage tribe. What do you mean by that?
I think that you can trace the development of childhood and compare it to the development of the human race. It's a kind of social version of ontology recapitulates phylogeny. You have, for example, the infant who is really inarticulate, unable to communicate with other people, like a primitive man in the beginning of evolution. Then you have a toddler whose world is small but social. It's a world in which women like his mother, his babysitter, his daycare lady, are dominant, and of course anthropologists, archaeologists are now telling us that early mankind, I suppose we should say early humankind now, because so many of them are feminists, was a world in which women were very important. Then you get to a stage of early social life in which the gang is important, a wider horizon, elementary school age, and that's a world in which people are literate, but only in a minor way. What really counts is the oral culture. And so you can make this kind of connection between the development of childhood and the development of the human race. And it's in this sense that I think children are a tribe. They're like that phase of human development, tribal culture.
Well, parenthetically, I have this feeling about childhood, Tobias Wolff wrote a wonderful memoir called This Boy's Life.
Oh, yes, isn't that good?
Yes, it is. And he believes that childhood was not the idealistic childhood that you would see in Meet Me in St. Louis and that you would see in the B-movies that MGM put out, but childhood is really a very traumatic period, and because childhood is very specific, hardly anybody has an ideal childhood. And to make this to show some evidence for this point of view, you can look at a playground. And when my child was growing up, he's now in his 20s, but when he was growing up, the playground was literally a jungle.
Mm-hmm.
It was free. You had to separate children all the time. They were attacking each other, taunting each other. And thank God that we don't live as children. It's not idealistic. Only as we become adults do we establish a social order that allows us to communicate on a human level. Don't you think that's true?
Well, I think your view is a little pessimistic. I'm afraid your son went to a very unhappy kind of school. I don't remember this in my school at all, but perhaps...
Talking about the playground.
Well, but even on the playground, I think it depends... how many teachers are on the playground, perhaps. If you just let them out of the door and go away, you can get a certain amount of savagery, particularly if the playground isn't properly equipped. You know, if you've got woods and fields and slides and swings and sandboxes the way you had in my elementary school, I think things are nicer. If you're boxed in by cement walls and half the equipment is broken, you do get a savage situation. It's like those poor rats who are in too small a space and become so mean.
What about William Golding's Lord of the Flies? There's a group of children left on their own, and they revert to savagery.
Well, I know that I think this is a brilliant book, and of course, again, he's putting them in an extreme situation. Most children are not in that extreme situation. Unfortunately, right here in New York, there are plenty who are. But I think in the kind of world I grew up in my children grew up in, their needs are taken care of. They're restrained by parents. I don't think things get to that condition with most children, though I'm sure they can. The Lord of the Flies is being played out in vacant lots right up in Harlem today, probably.
Now, Alison Lurie, you say, and don't tell the grown-ups, that there are two types of books on the library shelves. Tell me about that.
Well, I think first there are the books that children love and respond to and recognize naturally. And these are this is what I call subversive children's literature. It's not subversive in the political sense, and not always subversive in an extreme way, but these are books that take children seriously, that don't try to put over false ideas of what the world is like, that are not trying to improve them morally at the expense of their natural impulses. And then I think there are a lot of books, goody-goody children's books, as Mark Twain called them, that really children don't like. They often get awards, but they're books written about a kind of childhood that doesn't exist. One of the things that I think you can use to tell them apart is that in these goody-goody books, the children are not only grow and learn, which can happen in the subversive books too, but the way they grow and learn is through the help of some wise adult. And what they learn very often is to conform. There is a genre of books when I was growing up, and again when my children were growing up, in which there's a little engine or a little steamboat or a little airplane who goes off the tracks or gets into some kind of trouble, and they're rescued and helped by some older engine or tugboat or airplane who teaches them that they must follow the rules and do the right thing. And this lesson is repeated over and over again. So there's this theme. And then there's also, much more in the past than today, a whole series of school texts in which there's this normal family, this Dick and Jane family, which the mother stays home and the father goes to work, and the little boy is adventurous and the little girl is timid, and the dog is adventurous and the cat is timid. I mean, these are the books that I think make children grow up hating to read.
In many respects, I guess children want the same kind of books adults do, don't they? I mean, adults don't want to be preached to. They don't want to be moralized. They want to read about situations that deal with their problems in their lives.
Well, I think that's certainly true in fiction. Judging by the number of self-help books in the stores today, adults may want to be preached to. They want to be scolded and told how to lose weight and how to be a better lover and how to be nicer to their own children. But those books don't pretend to entertain or amuse or appeal to the imagination. I think that there's a need for these books. There are books on manners for children, and I have nothing against them. There are books on how to take care of yourself for a teenager. I have nothing against them. It's when the moral lesson is disguised as imaginative fiction that it bothers me.
Yeah, those self-help books, I mean, they're ridiculous when you think about it. They're aimed at people who are desperate for some change in their lives, and they don't know how to do it. The people who read those books are probably the people who join cults and things.
I don't believe that. I think that some self-help books are very useful. I learned, for example, that my cholesterol was high at one point. I went to the library. I got a book that told me about how to lower my cholesterol. I think these books have a place, but it's the disguising of this kind of lesson that bothers me, really.
Now, one of the books on your subversive list is The Wizard of Oz. How's that a subversive book?
It was subversive, very subversive at the time it was written. It was published in 1900. It's about a little girl who goes off and has adventures on her own, who doesn't conform to the rules. She's the one who says to the wizard, "You're a humbug." She's the one who rebels against the witch and pours a pail of water over. And this is at a time when good little girls would never do such things, a time in which popular children's books were full of good little girls who did what they were told and didn't go off and have adventures with strange animals and men they'd never met.
Wizard of Oz is one of the few books written by American writers that you mention in Don't Tell the Grown-Ups. You seem to favor the British writers. Well, why is that?
Well, that was the focus of the book. I think partly because there are more British classics, the tradition goes on longer. But certainly, you could write such a book about American authors. There'd be more contemporary writers in it and fewer 19th century writers. But it was just a choice I made because these were the books that moved me when I was growing up.
Now, your premise is, as I understand it, is that these subversive books overturn the conventional values of the period. And one of those books is Alice Through the Looking Glass, I believe it's called. I always get the title. Alice in Wonderland.
Well, there are two of them, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking
Glass.
Through the
Looking Glass, yes. That is also, those are also subversive books?
At the time, that was very subversive. For example, both those books, the villainous or the figure that's fun is made of is a queen, a rather pompous, self-important queen, the Duchess and the Red Queen, and they're both obvious caricatures of Victoria and her court. And this is something that an adult writer could never have gotten away with at the time. But because he was writing for children and disguised it, Lewis Carroll was going to do this, able to do this. I was thinking of what you were saying about American books. I'd like to write about them. Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time, for instance, came out, when it came out, it was subversive in a similar way in that it was about a girl who's interested in math and a boy who's hopeless at math and interested in art and literature, reversing the stereotypes of that period. I mean, now we have plenty of girls going into math, and I think we're even beginning to have boys who are not ashamed to go into the arts. But again, at the time, these books are subversive. Sometimes later on, they don't seem so unusual.
Well, now, you have written a number of children's books, haven't you?
Well, not really. I've retold folk tales. I've done three collections of retold folklore. But all I did was to choose the stories and tell them over again in contemporary language.
Aimed at children?
Aimed at children, oh yes.
Is there a real difference? I think I asked this question, maybe let me rephrase it. Is there a real difference between books geared to children and books geared to adult?
Today, I think that...
Other than intention. I mean, obviously, here a book would be written for a particular age bracket, so you have to deal in terms of language.
Well, I think certainly. I mean, for one thing, the happy ending, which is almost taboo in adult literature, serious adult literature today, still survives in children's books. And it's even expected. If children are on a quest, they will find what they're looking for. If someone is in trouble, they will be helped. So there's that. And then, of course, there's the obvious difference that in children's books, at least books for children in elementary school, there's no sex. And until recently, death was taboo in children's books. E.B. White was one of the first people to break that taboo. Though, interestingly enough, in the 19th century, children's books were full of death. The good little children were constantly being taken away by the angels.
What about Judy Blume's books? Are they subversive?
I think that they are, or they certainly were, in the beginning. And one sign of this was that it took a long time for them to be accepted by authorities. They were about children who questioned some of the rules of the day. Now they seem fairly conventional. But, for instance, there was a book about a girl who couldn't stand her little brother, whereas in more conventional books of the time, girls always loved their little brothers.
That'll be the day.
Yes. Well, you'd be surprised in the Dick and Jane kind of book, there was none of this conflict. I think that she's popular partly because she always takes the child's side.
But Judy Blume does have sex in,
yes.
in her books and a more explicit language than you.
Yes, well, she also writes for older children, for adolescents.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the books like Flubber, is it Flubber or Blubber or something like
that? Yeah, something like that.
And Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, those books. Yes, she also has a series of books for children in junior high, which deal with all these things. For example, she has a book in which menstruation is mentioned. That was a tremendous breakthrough, although it had been done before by Louise Fitzhugh in the sequel to Harriet the Spy, a book which caused Harriet the Spy caused a controversy, and then there was a sequel called The Long Secret, in which a friend of Harriet's actually does reach puberty. This caused a tremendous amount of talk. Did we really want this book, to give this book to our children? Of course, this is years ago now.
I remember a few years ago, one of Judy Blume's books was banned by a small school district in the southern part of New Jersey. So I called the school superintendent and did an interview on the telephone with this fellow. And he said, well, there was too much explicit language. Mm-hmm. And I said, would you read me the words that are offensive? He said, yes. I said, are you going to put this on the radio? And I said, I'll have to listen to the words, but read me the list of words. And he did. There was gut, there was damn, there was hell. I think there might have been a goddamn. And they were words all like that. So I did a piece with my show. I said, and I outlined the controversy, and I said, at the end of this broadcast, I will have the school superintendent read to you a list of words that are so offensive that they cannot be found on the library shelf in the school district. And you know, there wasn't, the station manager never complained, the vice president for the radio division never complained. No audience ever complained because these words in our context, language context today, are so innocuous.
I know. And
he just picked out a word.
And children use these words. I mean, the first time your four-year-old comes home and says, damn, you know, your hair stands on end, but you get used to it.
Yeah. And it gets worse, too.
Yeah, and it can get worse, yeah.
Well, what about the censorship in school districts of children's books? Do you have a feeling
about
that?
I think it's gone much too far in certain places. When you read the list of books that have been banned in schools, particularly in the Bible Belt, it's amazing. I mean, things that you never would think of. The Wizard of Oz, for example, has been banned because there's a good witch in it. Glinda the Good is a good witch. And these are the same people that want to stamp out Halloween, because Halloween is a pagan festival, and children dress up as devils, and
Of course, there is a such a thing as an age-appropriate book.
Oh, I think so too.
And therefore, you might restrict books that a child would be confused. Or...
Oh, I certainly believe that.
But they don't restrict on that basis, really, do they? They do it for political or religious reasons.
No, it's for political and even more for religious reasons, I think.
But it would strike me, I wouldn't really care, even if a child would read an age-inappropriate book, if the child were interested enough to want to read it. I would be so delighted, because there are so many children who don't read at all. To see a child really wanting to read, I would give that child every encouragement.
I know. I mean, when you hear that the Wizard of Oz is banned in some small town school where the children can turn on the television and watch murder and rape and see blood running down the screen, I mean, it's just amazing to me that this could go on.
Well, my mother, when I was an adolescent, my mother used to get on my back all the time. She would say, Don, all you read is science fiction. Why don't you put that science fiction down and read something good? But I did read something good before and after my science fiction phase. It was a wonderful thing that I was an adolescent who read, and I would encourage an adolescent to read science fiction or any genre.
I would too. I think there's some wonderful science fiction being written.
And there's some lousy science fiction being written.
Yes, but after a while, the lousy science fiction begins to bore you. You say, "Not another bug-eyed monster," you know.
Yeah, I remember I was about 13 when I discovered Ray Bradbury.
He's so good.
Wonderful. It was wonderful. I read The Illustrated Man and The Martian Chronicles, and I had a pal down the block. And I had paperback, I still have those paperbacks of The Illustrated Man and The Martian Chronicles, and it was just, the language was so beautiful and so vivid and so nostalgic. And I remember running down the block and thrusting these books on my pal, who was also about 13. I said, and he also read science fiction. The bug-eyed monster type. So a few days later, he dropped the books over to my house, and he says, "I didn't think they were so good."
Aw, that's always so disappointing.
Yeah, you wanted to share your enthusiasm, you know.
I know it.
Always do that.
But sometimes you can, you know. It's wonderful to give someone a book that you've loved, and they love it, too.
And share it. Yeah. We're almost out of time. I did want to ask you one or two questions about the folk tales and how folk tales work into... children's literature. There seem to me that there is a relationship, and yet they're not. Just folk tales are really of the oral tradition, aren't they?
They are, but of course children begin by getting all literature orally, because you begin reading to your children before they can read for themselves. So, I think that the best books for very small children are still in the oral tradition. They're written to be heard rather than to be read quietly to yourself. So I think the change is very gradual, and I think that the themes of folk tales, of folklore generally, are very strong in children's literature. The quest, rule of three, the magical helper who is strange or eccentric or is an animal or a supernatural being, sibling rivalry. A lot of the themes of folklore are carried over into children's literature.
These folk tales are really vivid in terms of violence, aren't they?
Some of them are, but not all of them. I mean, there are folk tales in which there is no violence. A lot is.
Well, they're not as good, though.
Well, I think.
Isn't it true that really in most fiction, the most effective fiction always has sex and violence in it?
Well, not always. I think so. I can think of depends what you mean by sex and what you mean by violence. I mean
sex and violence.
I mean, Jane. You can say that in Jane Austen there's sex, but there's not sex in the sense that then. We'd mean it today if it was printed on a book cover, and there's not much violence, and yet she's a wonderful writer. I think were used to sex and violence, but I think you can, there are wonderful books which don't contain them, and they're being written today even now.
I think you state in the sections on the folktales that women have a much stronger role in the stories than in some later fiction. Is that true?
Well, if you look at masses of folktales, that's true. If you look at the folktales that we know best, women are rather passive, and I've written about this many times. But these are stories that were told by women, passed along by women, during the centuries in which most published literature, most public literature was written and passed on by men. So this is a woman's literature, and naturally women are important in it.
Is there any children's book that stands out as perhaps the most influential, say, Beatrix Potter's Peter Rabbit?
Influential in general? I don't know.
Well, how it impacted on children, how the book influences children, and does the job that the book is supposed to do.
I mean,
there are a whole bunch of books. I mean, you have book after book that are outstanding children's books, but is there any one? Are there any one or two that you could focus as the most influential of children's
no,
books?
No, because children are different, and for each child will have a different book. I think the books I've written about, plus the American classics that I haven't written about at length, like Tom Sawyer and The Wizard of Oz and The Little House on the Prairie and A Wrinkle in Time, Charlotte's Web. All these books have been very influential, but I don't think there's one single one that works for everybody. That's why we need more than one.
I recall that the heroine of Foreign Affairs taught children's literature.
That's true, she did.
Gave you the opportunity to really know that heroine pretty well, didn't it?
Well, I wanted to write about an American academic in Europe, and I knew that I couldn't, without a lot of work, fake her as an 18th century specialist or a scholar of Shakespeare. I would have had to go to the library and learn things, but giving her this specialty, I could more or less avoid that task.
Where does Dr. Seuss stand in the hierarchy of children's literature?
Well, now he's in an interesting situation. He's terribly influential now. He's beginning to be accepted, whereas at the beginning people were very suspicious of him. And as you may know, his first book was turned down by immense number of publishers. I can't remember the number, but something like 33 publishers turned down to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which did in fact have a subversive message. It's about a boy who makes up what he sees on his way home from school, and his imagination takes a cart and a horse and driver and turns him into a whole circus. When he gets home, his father asks him what he saw, and he says, Nothing I said growing red as a beet, but a plain horse and driver on Mulberry Street. In other words, he conceals his imaginative life from a parent whom we've already learned is not sympathetic to it.
Well, Alison Lurie, by the way, what sort of person studies with you or takes your course?
All kinds of people. Everything from people who want to write children's books or go into children's book publishing, up to people who are on some athletic team and think it's going to be a snap course and have to drop out after a couple of weeks when they find it's not.
Well, don't tell the grown-ups. Very interesting look and an interesting way of describing certain children's literature as subversive. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Alison Lurie. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for inviting me.